You are listening to Agent Court Church's audio podcast. For more information on Agent Court Church, including service times, how to connect, and campus locations, please visit our website at onechurch.to.
Good morning, everyone. It's amazing what one simple action can do when it's done in love to change the trajectory of somebody's life. It's amazing how one simple action can do. Friends, we're talking about love today, and love is principally an action. It's something we do. It's something we do. And in Darren's story, you see it's a simple act of those who are greeting on that day, welcoming him in a sincere way, full of love. And Paul would say this. He said that we serve one another in love. That's what it would say in the Bible. Paul wrote those words a long time ago. He said, serve one another in love. It's an action. So as a community, a church community, we've identified two action steps that any one of us can participate in order to both experience love and also give love to the community and the people in our city. So the first one is this. Anybody can serve. Anybody can serve. In fact, if you go to our website, onechurch.to/serve, you can see a multitude of service opportunities at any one of our campuses where you can get involved. You know, I have this dream, and you know, it's not like it's a major dream, but it feels major. I have a dream that someday that there will be enough people inspired to serve in the parking lot. Ooh, glamorous, eh? That maybe everybody who comes on this campus, whether they're walking or busing or driving, they would get welcomed before they even got in the building. And that when it's raining, like it's raining today, that they'd be out there with umbrellas, helping people get in so that they're dry when they arrive. How many think that would be nice? Or if that they're lugging kids. I mean in love, though. You don't lug your kids. You lug them in love, right? And they have a lot of gear with them, that there's somebody helping them in. I just think, man, wouldn't that be amazing to serve people like that? Our ushers serving with a smile, and we need more of them, and people greeting, people in children's ministry. I think we are short a couple of musicians, too, if you can play a musical instrument, if you can sing. Hey, if anyone can do choreography, Van needs help. Van needs help. That's what I call a walk. I don't call that a dance. But love is principally an action. So one step action we can do is by serving. The other one is this, to get involved in a group. It's an action to connect. So we have these groups in our church, onechurch.to/groups/groups. /groups. It's there. And here's an opportunity for all of us to get involved in a community group. And our community groups, I was a part of one this last fall, or last year, earlier this year. What a fantastic way to get to know people, care for one another, edify each other, grow deeper in our faith together. It's an important step. If you're not involved in a community group, I would invite you to go to our groups lounge. It's right to my left, your right when you, or your left when you leave this room. And the groups lounge, Pastor Dale will be there with his team. By the way, Pastor Dale, his birthday was yesterday. He turned 29-ish. And go ahead and wish him a happy birthday when you go there to register for a community group. Be a part of something. You can take action. Love is primarily an action. It's something that you and I do. It's something we express. So today I want to talk about love in the context of our vision series. Last week we talked about knowing God. And if you didn't receive one of these pamphlets on the way in last week, please indicate to our ushers on the way out. They'll have them. In it was a spiritual life track. And this fall, we have lots of opportunities for you to come to know God better. Remember last week, we talked about the work of the Holy Spirit. And I cannot overstate this, but I could understate it, and I don't want to. We need the help of the Holy Spirit to know God. If you're going to go deep God diving, we need the Spirit, because knowing God is principally a spiritual connection. It's something spirit to spirit we feel and we experience. And that's what takes us deeper. It moves us from knowing about God, knowing about church, knowing of God, to knowing God intimately. It's a significant, radical difference. And today's message is as radical. Loving people. Loving people. So in the context of that, I thought, let's start with some reading some Bible verses together, because I know it's 11:15 a.m. Actually, it's 12 minutes to noon, so I know you're ready to roll, aren't you? I'm going to read some, we're going to put some scriptures up. They're all written by the Apostle Paul, and he's talking about love. He's unpacking the weight of love and what love means here in these verses. So watch them closely, and read when you read them out loud with me, whenever you see the word love, give it a little extra, okay? Let's try it. Here's some words from Paul. Let's read it together. For the entire law is fulfilled in keeping this one command, love your neighbor as yourself. Now, before we move on, do you notice this? Entire law. The entire law. 613 commands. The entire law is in keeping this one command, love your neighbor as yourself. Okay, wow. Let's see what else Paul has to say. But the fruit of the Spirit is
love.
Okay. Do everything in love. Do everything in love. Wow. Mean even serving? Especially serving. Here we go. And over all these virtues, put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity. Let's look at this next one. And this is my prayer, that your love may abound more and more in the knowledge and depth of insight, so that you may be able to discern what is best and may be pure and blameless for the day of Christ. Love is essential. And look at this last one. For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision has any value. The only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. The only thing that counts. These are radical words. I detect a pattern here. Do you? I think love's important. And he says the only thing that counts, the only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through what? Through love, through love. Friends, this is radical. This goes against our culture. This goes against everything maybe that comes natural to us in our culture. He says, Paul says some astounding things. He says the entire law, 613 commands could be summed up in this. The only thing that counts is love. He radicalizes love here when he says loving your neighbor is the entire law. Now, when you think of that, because to Paul, expressing love is the totality of God's will for us. And when he makes these statements, he's identifying with Jesus, who said this when he was confronted in Acts by religious people, different groupings, what's the greatest command? And he said this, love God, love people. Love God, love people. As far as I know, he's the first one to put those two get together. They're two independent, different books of the Bible in the Old Testament, and he puts them together. He says, want to know what's most important? Love God, love people. Love people. But the question is, what is love? I mean, what is love? If we look to define love from our culture's perspective, or even from what we think or feel and what's inside of us, likely it'll come down to a feeling. Love is a feeling, right? It's something I feel. And that's why sometimes I feel like I love you and sometimes I feel like I don't, right? If love is a feeling, how many have been in and out of love many times this week? Many times, many times. No, feelings can be a part of love, but that's not what love is. It can't be what love is. In our culture, sometimes people think love is romance because that's often in media, that's what's displayed. But romance is not an essential part of love at all. You can live your entire love, your entire life, and not experience romance and be very fulfilled, according to the scripture. There's different types of love. But I'll tell you this. I think in our culture, above any other definition of love, I think I see this, that love, people feel in our culture and society that love should be easy. Should be easy. I know I love them because it's just easy. How many, if you have children, you know it's not always easy. If you're married, you know it's not often easy. If we think love is easy, we're going to be tipping and back and forth, feeling like people owe us things all the time because love was supposed to be easy and this is not easy, so I might as well go. I might as well leave. It's requiring more of us in these moments. Listen, if you want a definition for love, don't look to culture. I would say this, don't even look inside yourself. If you want a definition of love, look at the relationship between God and his church, God and his son Jesus, God and even Israel, And you begin to get a snapshot of what real love looks like. In fact, the greatest and most accessible example of love to us today is in the person of Jesus. And here's the thing. We're called, if you're a follower of Jesus, you're called to love people like Jesus did. And on the surface, that sounds good, doesn't it? I mean, don't you love the way Jesus loved? I loved how he loved the marginalized. People who had been despised and rejected, and how maybe the power brokers and the important people of the day. Jesus noticed them and he loved them. I love that aspect of Jesus' love. I love how he loved people who were mourning. People were hurting, and he came alongside them, and he loved them. Don't you love that about Jesus? I love how he loved men and women equally in a culture that didn't always treat them equally. In fact, everywhere he went, he elevated them, and it was such a healthy love being expressed to men and women. And this is from a man who lived scholars believe, close to 33 years here on earth. He was a single adult male all of those years, and he maintained these healthy relationships with both men and women that really lifted them up around him. I mean, what kind of love is that? Isn't that amazing, friends? Now, that's Jesus' love. That's the love we should walk in. But here's where it gets a little difficult. Because on the surface, all of those forms of love sound good. But the measure of how much we love is actually measured by the people we find hardest to love. I heard one guy say it this way, read it somewhere, and I probably shared it in this context. I know I have before. Because there is something that we keep the love God, know God in one quadrant, and the love people in another quadrant. And it's to our benefit. But really, the measure and the depth of our relationship with God, how healthy and how close we are to God, is measured in the New Testament through the life of Jesus by the health of our relationships with other people. Well, and I don't like that. Do you? I mean, I'd rather keep short accounts with God and not have to bother with some people in my life, right? What we're going to read in the moment, there's two adjectives I want to give about the person of Jesus. If we're going to be a community that loves, it's going to be messy. It's not always easy. Because it's easy to love people that are lovely, right? Have you ever found that it's easy to love people that totally agree with you all the time? I mean, that's easy, right? Like, I mean, that's why it's so easy to love Shelley. She always agrees with me. She's here this morning and... She sometimes agrees with me. Let's be honest in this moment. You know, here's the thing. This is the type of love that I think could best be described as rugged love. Following Jesus is an invitation, a radical invitation, into a rugged type of love. Not a feely, loosey-goosey love, but a rugged type of love. Turn to someone next to you and say, "You're looking rugged today. Looking rugged today." Some of you enjoyed that compliment. Some of you were not fishing for that one. You're looking for something better. Another word or adjective I thought of when I was thinking of the love of Jesus, and you'll see in a moment as we look in Matthew chapter 8, if you want to open your Bibles there, open your phone there, we're going to spend a little time in Matthew chapter 8. Here's another adjective that could be used to describe the type of love that Jesus calls us in to love other people, and it's simply this. It's a gritty love. It is a rugged, gritty love that takes action. And you're going to see it on full display this morning. This is not a feeling love. Feelings will follow your actions eventually. But this is a rugged commitment, a gritty type of love if we're going to love like Jesus. Matthew chapter 8, verse 1. Let's jump right into the text here. Here's what it says. It says, "When Jesus came down from the mountainside, large crowds followed him." Let me give you the context. In Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7, the three previous chapters in that same book, and I'd invite you to read that. If you're not a follower of Jesus, you might want to read that this week. Jesus gives what is called the Sermon on the Mount. It is the Beatitudes. This is the greatest message ever spoken. And it is the most radical message because Jesus contrasts the culture and the world he lived in that looked a lot like ours with what his kingdom would look like and what it meant to follow him. But this message was so amazing. It was like a moment when Jesus would have dropped the mic, walked away. If you get that, you get everything. And he's coming down off the mountainside after having given this message. And there's a large crowd. There's lots of large crowds. Lots of large crowds around Jesus. There's a large crowd because they're amazed. He speaks as one with authority. He has insights to things that nobody else has seen. And it's an invitation to a radical lifestyle change where in God's kingdom, everything that's up is actually down and everything that's down is actually up. It's the inverse of how we're taught to live in this world. So following Jesus is radical. And this large crowd follows him down from the mountain. And here's what happens. A man with leprosy came and knelt before him. Now, put yourself in the sandals of this crowd. Imagine we're the crowd. You're pumped. You're amazed at Jesus' teaching. You're thinking and starting to wonder, is he the Messiah? Is he the one that's going to come and free us from the Romans? This is a great momentum swing. Jesus has never been popular. He can feel the momentum. The crowd can feel the momentum. They're probably feeling like, let's just go to Jerusalem. Let's take over. And then a lowly leper that's despised by all stops the parade. Can you imagine? The crowd's going to start judging that leper, right? Oh, another one of them. They're always getting in the way. Look at them. Jesus is stopping. Listen, this was going so good up until this moment. But this leper gets in the way and knelt before him and he said this. This is a picture of perfect faith. He said, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Perfect faith is not, I know you will, I know you will, I know you will. Perfect faith is, I know you can, I know you can, I know you can, and I hope you will. And this leper says, Lord, if you are willing, I know you can make me clean. The leper falls at his feet. And Jesus does the coolest thing. This is what he says. He responds to them, and I love it. He said, I am willing. I am willing, be cleaned. Now, if the crowd was pumped coming off the mountainside after the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount, they are going crazy now because now, their internal narrative has all changed. It's no longer judging the leper. No. Because they've seen the demonstration of power and everybody loves power. And all of a sudden, they're like, wow, look at this. Not only can he preach, look what happens. That leper, look, this is what I love about Jesus. He's not too haughty. No, he's humble enough to even a poor leper. Now, all of a sudden, their thoughts are all sympathetic towards this leper. Why? Because, they've just seen a healing. They've just seen God on display. Incredible moment. This moment is a moment where someone who's overlooked has been transformed. They've been healed. He's preached this message. Emotions are running high, and then what happens changes everything. See, I don't know if I can do this text justice today. I don't know if I can help you feel what this crowd felt, but I'm going to do my best this morning. Because in verse 5, something changes. The whole thing swings on a dime. It seems kind of similar at first, because a leper, a needy person, stood before Jesus. And another needy person will stand before Jesus, but they're very different. Here's what it says. It says in verse 5, when Jesus had entered Capernaum, and that was his home base, that was where he's from. When he entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him asking for help. Period. Now, this is a centurion. This is a Roman. This is the man that they probably just fantasized about just moments before that Jesus would free them from the oppression of the Romans. Here's a centurion standing before him. It's not just the man. He represents an empire. And the interaction between Israel and the empire of the Roman Empire has a checkered past, to say the least. In fact, 60 years before Jesus was born, in 63 BC, a man named Pompey came into Jerusalem. And he was going to attack this great fortified city, and it was going to be a long war. But what happened was he had some sympathizers inside, and they opened the gates at night, and they let Pompey in. And Pompey, as history records, he went in on his horseback through the city gates up to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. And as they went into the temple area in the courts, they killed every one of the priests. And then he ascended the stairs to the temple, and he went behind the veil, the Holy of Holies, to see what this Jewish God looked like. And you know what he found? Nothing. And it baffled Pompey, because he was used to a God that was a statue, a God that was an image. So Pompey left Judea and Galilee, and Judea and Galilee would be under the Roman oppression from that day on. A few years later, in 54 BC, a man named Crassus came back to the temple, and he went and he pillaged it. He took everything of value, all of the gold, all of the things they used to worship God. Here's what he did. He took it all, and he even took some of the priests, and he brought them back to Rome. And he paraded them down the main boulevard in Rome and to cheering crowds among other nations that had been conquered and their gods, because they were showing, and he was bragging and displaying, that even the God of this country had to submit to Caesar, mighty Caesar, a god himself. If that wasn't bad enough, in 40 BC, Rome would appoint a king over Israel or Judea to control it. He'd become known as Herod the Great. And Herod the Great was titled the King of the Jews, and it's interesting, he was an Edomite. He wasn't even a Jewish man, so it was a real affront to the Jewish people. And Herod the Great, there was nothing great about him. I mean, he had two of his wives murdered. He had three of his sons murdered. He did great buildings in that era and time on the backs of the people. He killed so many rabbis and Jewish leaders, he caused chaos in the nation. He loved to do that. One of his sons had John the Baptist beheaded. I mean, if you know the Christmas story at all, Herod the Great is the man who was so threatened by the potential of a new king, a baby born in Bethlehem, that he had all the boys murdered. All the young men, young boys murdered. His henchmen went in and did it. And the irony is, he was so old at that point, there was no way that baby would take over the throne before he died. But he didn't care. He's that insecure. So after Herod the Great, the king, trying to have a king on the throne didn't work. So his sons became tetrarchs, they called them, over certain regions. But the sole leader in Israel at the time Jesus is confronted by the centurion is a man named Pontius Pilate, who took over in 26 AD. Now, Pilate's an interesting guy. We don't know a lot about him, but a great historian, Josephus, writes a little bit about him. And when it came to Pilate, crucifixion had been introduced before, just so you know. It had been around for a while. The Romans had been leading Israel for quite a while, had been oppressing it. They had introduced crucifixion. In fact, in a village, in a city right next to where Jesus was born, about 3 miles away, Sepphoris, there was a great crucifixion that Jesus probably as a little boy would have seen, because it would have hung out there for a long time. So he would have walked by that, and he knew that would be him someday. But see, Pontius Pilate, he took crucifixion to a whole different level. He was very liberal with it, generous with it. And not just that, Pontius Pilate was famous for stealing from the treasury. And here's the thing he did. He would often convene meetings of the elders and the leaders of Israel, and he'd bring them together, and he'd have his henchmen in the crowd, and he'd have them beat them up. Just to prove, so you know who's boss. So when this centurion stands before Jesus asking for a favor nonetheless, there's a lot of history. There's a lot of water under the bridge. You catching that? There's a lot of water under the bridge. And not just that, he's a centurion. He's not a private. He's a man who rules armies. And in that context, this centurion... You became a centurion in the Roman army through two words, violence and submission. And you were committed to both of them. You asked no questions, and you did whatever it took. This man who stood before Jesus, he had done things that were unthinkable. He had done things that would have broken every Jewish law. And this is the man who stands before Jesus asking for a favor. Friends, do you think you can start to put your feet in the sandals of that crowd that day? Because all of us have a centurion. If you've lived any length of time, who's hurt you? Who offended you? Who hurt your children? Ooh. Who politically backstabbed you at work? Who's stolen from you? Who's taken from you? And in that context, maybe just like the centurion, maybe at some point in time they've had the audacity to come back and ask you for a favor. You know, can I have a reference? What type of employee were you, right? Or can I have some money? I don't have money because you took all our money. Oh, so now you want access to the children. You weren't interested for all those years. And now you're going to come in as the hero. I mean, can you get a little bit? This is what they're feeling in this moment. Jesus is their guy. He doesn't belong to the Romans. Jesus is their man. He's their hometown boy. He's their Messiah, not the world's Messiah, not as far as they're concerned. What's he doing with the Roman? You begin to feel a little bit like what that crowd must feel. But this is the ethic of love that is radical. Look what he says here in verse 6. He said, Lord, this is the centurion speaking. He said, Lord, my servant lies at home paralyzed. You know, it's interesting. That word servant is a gentle term because it's his slave. This is somebody he owns. We don't know where this slave was bought or purchased. Might be even a Jewish slave. But we do know this. Luke adds a little bit to the same narrative. And Luke says that the slave was highly valued. And we don't know why the slave is highly valued. But you get a sense that the centurion that's asking for a favor is not even so much just for his servant. It's because it will impact him personally. He will suffer a great loss. So he says, Lord, he said, my servant lies at home paralyzed. And these words just grabbed me. Suffering terribly. And I just thinking, if I was Jesus, I'd be looking at him going, are you serious? You're the personification of suffering. Like, can you imagine the crowd? What if Jesus turned to the crowd and say, how many have been hurt by the Romans? I mean, you could not have got that crowd to agree on many things. You know, do you like chicken or fish? You know, you wouldn't have got many, but everybody's hands would have gone up over that one. Yet nobody's pro-Roman in the crowd there, save maybe the guy in front of Jesus. This is the man who's standing in front of him. But here's what I love about Jesus and why I follow him and why you do. But it's tough at the same time. Because Jesus was born in this world to birth a new ethic, a new morality. Something that even flies in the face of common sense in our culture and world. See, he had just preached a sermon to end all sermons. Here's what he said in that sermon in Matthew chapter 5. He said this, if you love only those who love you, what reward is for that? Even corrupt tax collectors do that much. If you are kind only to your friends, how are you different from anyone else? Even pagans do that. Jesus is radical because he's saying this. Listen, if you only do to the Romans what they've done to you, you're no better than the Romans. If you only do to the tax collectors what they've done to you, you're no better than the tax collectors. Even sinners, even people that are far from God treat good people good. Even people far from God love people that love them. I mean, that's easy. That's low-hanging fruit, friends. And Jesus said, no, there's way more to this. And friends, before you check out in this message, because some of you are starting to think through the relationships and the wrongs that have been done to you, and you're starting to say, yeah, but, right? And you, do we not have a few yeah, buts? Yeah, but you don't understand. You know, yeah, but if I told you what was done to me, listen, I want to say that this is actually very beneficial to you if you'll let Jesus finish his message. In the context of this, Jesus says this to this Roman centurion who comes and asks for a favor. He says this. No, we're back one. Oh, hey, you know, I skipped one. Let's go to that one. Sorry. This is what he said in Matthew chapter 5. These are the words that I struggle with a lot. He said, but I say, what is that? Can you say it with me? Isn't that hard to say? I've never found that easy to say. Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. In that way, you will be acting as true children of God, Father in heaven. True children of your Father in heaven. How many have ever found it hard to just love people that you do love and that love you, let alone love your enemies? You know, how many find it hard to pray for people who support you, let alone pray for those who persecute you? Anyone been there? Me neither. I'm good there too. Feeling a little lonely, exposed in this moment. This ethic that Jesus leads us into, you know, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. You know, Jesus, how do I become a child of God? Love your enemies. Jesus, how do I know I'm right with you? Love your enemies. Because I already know you love the people that are lovely, but love your enemies. Jesus, how do I know I'm in sync with you? Is it coming to church? No. Love your enemies. Love your enemies. This Roman centurion needs a favor, and he's standing in front of Jesus. And in Matthew chapter 8, verse 7, he says this. There's so much in between. I'm not going to read it. But I want you to know he did it for him. He said, I will come and heal him. And in that moment, parts of the crowd would have left. Parts of the crowd would have been angered over this. This is a tipping point, but just bear with me for a moment. Let me ask you a question. Do you know why it's easier to love a stranger than it is to love someone who's offended you? Do you know why it's easier to love a stranger than it is to love your neighbor? Do you know why it's easier to love a stranger sometimes than it is somebody you're related to? It's because we find ourselves looking over the shoulder of Jesus at the centurion. And we find ourselves saying, deciding, will we be kind to them? Will we show them mercy? Whether or not we'll be loving, whether or not we'll be forgiving, whether or not we're going to do for him what he wouldn't do for me. And we get it all wrong. We're not standing over the shoulder of Jesus. We're standing over the shoulder of the centurion. Here's the hard part, and Jesus knew this would be hard for us. We have a tendency to see ourselves as the offended party. We don't often see ourselves as the offender. But the gospel says this: all of us have offended God. All of us have been offensive. Every human being. And in this narrative, we often see ourselves as the one being hurt, being offended. And Jesus makes a statement here in a minute that almost feels like it doesn't even fit in the story. But I'm going to show you how it does. But if you're ready to serve communion, friends, those who are going to be serving, if you can prepare yourself even now, we'll be wrapping this up in just a moment. See, Jesus, I can only imagine the tension that the crowd is feeling. The centurion asked for a favor. Everybody's on the tips of their toes going like, what is he going to do to our enemy? And Jesus grants him grace and forgives him and restores this person that needed healing. And in doing so, parts of the crowd would have left. You might have left. You might have been like, okay, if he's going to give that to him, why aren't you coming to my house and giving it to me? You know, you're supposed to be for us. You're going to free us from these people. And I could sure there was ripples, a little effect going through the crowd, a little shock. He's a Gentile. He's not one of us. Why would you do this for him? Then Jesus says some verses that at first I didn't know. You look at it, honestly, when you read these in a minute with me, you're going to be looking at it going like, is this part of the same story? And it is. Here's what Jesus said. He said, and I tell you this, he's turning to the crowd now, that many Gentiles will come from all over the world, from the east and the west, and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob at the feast in the kingdom of heaven. He's saying this, a lot of the people you think will never see the kingdom of heaven, they're coming. They're coming. Remember, we learned this last year, you know, the humble are in and the proud are out. And then he goes on to say this. He said, but many Israelites, many insiders, those whom the kingdom was prepared for, will be thrown into outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. If the crowd was thrilled with them before, they're not as thrilled right now. If I was to interpret this, and this was a lot of tension going on here, and people are trying to decide whether they're going to treat people as they deserve or as the Father would treat you. And in this moment, Jesus is basically saying, listen, the self-righteous, they're going to be sitting in the nosebleed seats in the kingdom of heaven. Those who just see themselves as the offended and never the offender, humble are in, proud are out. It's the man who and woman who realizes, I'm not Jesus. It's the man and woman who says, I am the centurion. I have the opportunity to do for someone what I pray my Father in heaven will do for me. This changes the narrative completely. This is radical, friends. 25 years after Jesus spoke this, Paul would say, he'd summarize it in Romans chapter 5. He'd say this, now most people would not be willing to die for an upright person. Though someone might perhaps be willing to die for a person who's especially good. And listen to this. But God showed his great love for us by sending Christ to die for us while we were still sinners, while we were still the offender, while we were still offensive, while we were yet lovable, while we were yet graceable. He graced us. He loved us. He died for us while we still had offended God. I mean, when Jesus did this, he took away all my excuses. Because I have a lot of excuses, don't you? For people who've hurt you in life. I have a lot of excuses. Not too long after this encounter with the centurion, Jesus would lay down his life for him. Not just for Israel. It says, but for God so loved the world. Now, the Israelites thought it was just them. No. Too small of a vision. Right from back in the old covenants in the Old Testament, it was always about the world. It was always about the entire world, knowing and experiencing the love of God and relationship with him. So here in this context, he's unpacking it, and they're seeing a larger vision of who it could be. It could even include people that were our enemies. It's incredible what love can do. Fact is, I'm a centurion asking God for a favor that I don't deserve. And every one of us is. And when we realize that, we understand how we can extend it to others. Now, let me put some of your minds at ease in this regard. Listen, to love someone doesn't mean you instantly trust them. Trust is something that's earned. I also want you to know this. To love and serve someone doesn't mean you're back in relationship with them. Some people, it's another message, another time. We talked about it in the last year in this context. There are people here that are not healthy enough to be close to you again because they could do destructive and terrible things. So it doesn't mean you embrace people and it's all back. But you know what it does? It means you serve them. So if somebody's really hurt you in the past, by serving them, it might be to forgive them. But I can't be in relationship with them. So I want you to understand that. A little bit of clarity around this. But Jesus doesn't let any of us off the hook here. And friends, this is hard because if we're going to love people the way Jesus loves people, it's going to require action. It's going to have to be gritty. It's going to have to be rugged. When everybody looks like us, acts like us, and believes the same things we do, that's easy. When people don't look like us, don't act like us, and don't believe the same things that we do, that's harder. But that's the rugged, gritty love, because every human being, regardless of whether we like them or not, are made in the image of God.
Make sure you don't miss a message by subscribing to this podcast. All creative content and production for this podcast is provided by the One Church Creative Team.